just seeing how much the counseling improved, how much provider attitudes and belief became less biased. It definitely was beyond what I expected.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Like all of us, healthcare providers probably bring their biases to work. But if those biases result in a reduced level of care for their patients, what can we do to correct them? Zach Wagner of USC and Manisha Shah of Berkeley are two of the researchers involved in an innovative project to reduce bias in the provision of family planning services in three countries. They join me now. Zach, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks, Tim.
And Manisha, welcome as well.
Thank you for having us, Tim.
Manisha, in general, when I'm talking about bias among healthcare providers, what do I mean?
Bias is about providers holding attitudes and or beliefs about different groups of people. And these attitudes or beliefs, they might be based on stereotype. They might lead to healthcare workers treating different groups of people differently. This can be bias from doctors, nurses, community health workers. And bias among healthcare providers is fairly well documented now in a variety of settings, whether that be bias based on caste or income or race or HIV status. I also want to add, though, that this bias can also be paternalistic in that it can be doctors who want to protect young people, for example, from having sex.
This has real-world consequences, I guess, as well. What sort of consequences does it have for the patients?
It can lead to poor quality care, poor health outcomes. It can exacerbate existing disparities that we already observe in health settings. Another big consequence that we worry about, especially in the context of this study, is that it can also just discourage people from seeking care, right? They just don't show up at the clinic.
I'm going to ask a naive question. Healthcare providers, they're scientifically trained, they're medically trained. So I could ask, why do these biases even exist?
I mean, look, healthcare workers are people too. We all bring our own attitudes and beliefs to work. All of us do this, right? And I think in general, provider bias, it stems from beliefs about certain groups that we have. And many of these beliefs are based on social norms, cultural beliefs, and we all have them.
You, in this case, are looking at family planning services provided in Tanzania, Burkina Faso, and Pakistan. What sort of biases might we expect to find in these cases?
In the setting for this study in these countries, and I would say more broadly in many countries, we were worried about biases related to age, marital status, and parity. Parity is the number of times a woman has given birth. And so for both age and marital status, there's often a sense that young people, especially young people who are unmarried, should not be having sex. And so they're often left out of traditional family planning and sexual and reproductive health outreach. The issue of parity, right, the number of times a woman has given birth, is related to this idea that married women upon marriage should actually be focused on having children before starting to use contraception. So if you're a nulliparous woman, right, nulliparous refers to a female who has never given birth to a live child. Often these women upon recent marriage are encouraged to have children before they start using contraception. And so we were really interested in biases against young women, young unmarried women, young nulliparous women in this study.
Does this mean that women in these categories, they cannot get contraception, or it's just very difficult, or it's unpleasant for them to try and get contraception?
Exactly. I would say all of those things, right? In some cases, they're just not showing up to get contraception. In other cases, they're showing up, but we worry that they may be being discouraged from taking up contraception because they're young or unmarried, et cetera.
Your research was based on a project called beyond bias. Can you tell me what beyond bias is, who it's targeted at?
The Beyond Bias Project set out to reduce provider bias experienced by young women ages 15 to 24 in these three countries, Burkina Faso, Tanzania, and Pakistan. And so this was a year-long intervention, and it was designed to be very broadly appropriate for most lower and middle income country settings. We were working in 227 clinics across three countries. So think roughly 75 clinics per country. Mm-hmm. And this was a multi-pronged intervention, multi-pronged in that there were three parts to the intervention. The first part of the intervention was a one-day training where we disseminated information to providers about, like, what is provider bias, right? What does it look like in family planning services? And then after that one-day training, what we did with the providers was we had ongoing support for them. And so we facilitated peer support where they could talk to each other and share knowledge. And this was both done in person as well as via WhatsApp groups. For the year-long intervention, they were able to talk to each other, maybe update some of their beliefs that they were having about the appropriateness of care for target groups. And part of this interaction was also to keep this information salient over time for them. Mm. And then the last part of the intervention, you know, it's a three-part intervention, was that we also had non-financial awards for clinics. The awards were designed as performance-based social incentives. And so the idea was to have clinics compete with one another to improve their services for clients under the age of 25. If you were a winning clinic, you would get stickers and you would get an award signed by the Minister of Health. And the idea, right, was to foster competition amongst the service providers to provide better care to young people.
This is quite a complex intervention, okay, and it's dealing with quite a sensitive subject. How did you plan what you were going to do?
So a lot of qualitative work went into designing the intervention. I think what was exciting about what we did here was we engaged in a lot of human-centered design work to figure out what the intervention would look like. There was a lot of qualitative work with providers and clients and, you know, trying to kind of understand what might move the needle before we actually went in and did this larger study.
And were the providers aware that there is provider bias?
Oh, good question. I would say some were aware, yes. But some know. A lot of this bias is really rooted in social norms. And so I would say there was a lot of heterogeneity amongst the providers on this topic.
So in measuring the impact of this intervention, what were you measuring and what did you do to measure it?
We used three quantitative data sources to measure the impact of the intervention. So the first source is provider surveys. So we surveyed about four providers across all the 226 health clinics that we're working in. And this was to measure provider bias and things that they said about how they treated their patients. Then we also used a ton of patient exit surveys. So over 70,000 patient exit surveys collected over 12 months. So just a massive amount of patient exit surveys. And then we also did these mystery client visits where we had women pretending to be real clients, randomized the attributes that they had. Some were young, some were unmarried, some were nulliparous, and every combination of those things. And then they went in and we measured what happened during the visit. And so that allowed us to see what happened in the group that received the intervention relative to the control group. And we randomized the intervention across all the clinics.
So when you're getting survey results from providers, are you sure that you're getting good information from them? Because clearly they have a motivation to tell you what you want to hear.
Yeah. Anytime you train people to do one thing and then you ask them if they did that thing, you should be concerned about the results. And so we did a lot of things to try and mitigate this. And so one, there was no indication that the survey team was related to the intervention team at all. Hopefully there was some sort of disconnect there. And then we also measured this across 47 different characteristics. And so we had this big, long list of characteristics that were related to bias. And we use that to create this index. And so using all these different characteristics and things that they might not even know this is meant to measure bias, that kind of helps with some of the self-report stuff. And then on top of that, we used the mystery clients. And so mystery clients providers didn't even know that they were actually measuring the outcomes.
When you have the measurable change in provider behavior, how much did they change?
We see about a 2-standard deviation reduction in a self-reported provider bias based on our provider bias index. Mm-hmm. So this is a pretty sizable reduction in self-reported bias. And this is very consistent across all of the 3 countries that we worked in. So this is really a very clear result.
And for the women who visited the clinics, what effects are we seeing on how they were treated? How were they prescribed?
Women that came into the clinic were much more likely to be counseled on the full range of methods. And so this means that providers offered them all of the methods that they're supposed to offer to every woman. And they also felt like they were treated better by the providers. And so the providers seemed to be nicer to them. And this was measured through the patient exit surveys. One thing that we didn't find was any change in the methods that the women received. So that's a little nuanced because we did find that the mystery clients thought they could receive more methods. And so we asked the mystery clients, like, did you think you could take this method? Did you think that you could take that method? And they thought that they could take a much wider range of methods in the treatment clinics, but the real clients did not actually take any different methods.
One of the reasons for that was 90% of women coming into the clinics were taking up methods already prior to our intervention. It's a harder needle to move when you're already at 90%.
One of the ways that we interpret that is that most of the women that come into the clinics, they know that they're probably not going to experience the bias that the mystery clients experience. So we designed the mystery clients to be this group that does experience bias, but it turns out that group doesn't show up to the clinic all that often.
Got it. Now, as you say, there are particular groups that are victims of this bias, that experience the bias. Was there any difference in the improvement in their treatment? Are some biases harder to correct than others?
Yeah, so we found some very interesting results here. First of all, we found that different client characteristics lead to different types of bias. The women without children, they were counseled on fewer methods. The providers tended to not counsel them on hormonal methods because they thought that that would make them less likely to be able to have a child in the future.
Wow.
And so we actually did find a big improvement of the intervention there, where the disparity for nulliparous women was pretty much wiped out by the intervention. For young women, we found that they were less likely to be offered a method at all. So young women thought that they wouldn't have been able to take any method. We don't find a whole lot of change here, but in Tanzania, we did find that maybe the intervention was improving that domain a little bit. Unmarried women felt like they were treated worse than married women. And so that was a very clear disparity across all 3 countries. We did not find any change in that. So the unmarried women still felt like they were treated worse, even at the intervention clinics.
Part of the evaluation you did here was using qualitative interviews. I don't discuss these very often on Vox Dev Talks. You don't see very many of them in economic research. What was the value of doing these in a situation like this?
The qualitative work we did, not only did we do a lot in the beginning to understand what the intervention should be, but then we also did a lot of qualitative work at the end to understand the results better. In that when you talk about something like bias, this is something very hard to measure in a quantitative way. And so it's often easier to talk to people to really understand what might be going on. And I think the qualitative data has given us a richness to this study and has taught us a lot. Let me give you one example of something that we learned. So during the qualitative interviews, we learned that for the providers who participated in the intervention, many of them shared that they faced a lot of structural challenges in delivering the kind of unbiased care that they had learned about during the sessions. You know, so for example, they had learned that young people might require more visual or auditory privacy, or that they should be creating safe youth-only spaces in their clinics. unfortunately, because of structural challenges, they weren't able to do this. And so while in the quantitative data, we do see big attitudinal changes coming from the providers, that didn't necessarily manifest into big changes in service delivery. We didn't observe huge changes in contraceptive uptake, for example. And so part of this could have been the result of some of these structural issues that we learned about in the qualitative data. What we've learned, and especially for me going forward, this is an interesting part of the causal chain that we just wouldn't have captured in the quantitative data.
You must have had some prior expectation going into this of how successful you would be and what the challenges would be. Did the intervention have the impact that you expected when you started?
For me, yes and no. Yes, in that we did observe big improvements in provider bias. I think we were all a little surprised about how this didn't necessarily translate into, you know, huge changes in the types of contraceptive that young women were using. I think part of the issue for me is that if you look at our data, we had very few young people coming in the first place.
Right.
And so it's obviously then harder to see impacts on these young people when very few are coming in. One thing we didn't move that I would have liked to have moved was that needle, right? How do we get more young women into these clinics? Granted, this was only a year-long intervention. And so it might be the case that more young people are coming in now. But I think this is definitely something we need to understand better, right? Like, how do we encourage these young folks, these young women to come in and use the services provided by these clinics?
Zach, did you get the results you were expecting?
I'd say the results exceeded my expectations just based on what the intervention was. It's really mostly an informational intervention in the beginning. We do have these non-financial awards, but I think the way the awards were designed, they weren't getting at the providers enough. And so they were kind of clinic-based. The clinic administrators were the ones who were mostly dealing with the intervention administrators. Some of the providers might have barely even known that they were part of this non-financial award. And so if this is just this informational intervention that happens one time at the beginning and then a continued WhatsApp intervention after that can have this level of effect, I think that's pretty promising. Just seeing how much the counseling improved, how much provider attitudes and belief became less biased. It definitely was beyond what I expected.
If you went back now and did it again, then you could redesign the intervention or you could alter the incentives, what might you change?
I know one of the things that the economists on the team early on had pushed for was financial awards. Mm-hmm. As you may have guessed, this is a highly interdisciplinary team. The human-centered design folks in the end pushed for these non-financial awards. And in the end, I don't think they had as large of impacts as we would have liked. And so I would be curious to go back and do this again with financial incentives.
One lingering question is which aspect of the intervention worked the best?
Uh-huh.
We really don't know. It's this package of three. We've done some things to try and untangle the effects of each, but we really just don't have a good sense. And that's really important for scale up because some of these cost more than others. Financial incentives are the most expensive part. So what does this intervention look like if we don't do that? Or if we just do the initial summit? And so I think that designing it in a way that we could untangle those things, that's incredibly expensive because you have to have a lot more clinics enrolled. But I think we'd learn a lot from that.
So that's the scaling up, not the scaling out, because as you mentioned, Manisha, this is designed to be used in many countries. But of course, cultural religious norms, they vary very widely.
Yes.
Across those countries. Where might it be difficult to shift attitudes? Where might you need to alter the type of intervention?
So one thing I want to stress about this project, which I think is so exciting, is we explicitly designed it to be in three very different countries.
Right, yes.
Three very different religious backgrounds, three places with very different cultural and social norms. And part of this was to increase the generalizability of the findings, right? In that if we were to find similar things across these places, it would say something about the intervention. And honestly, one of the things I've been most surprised by is given how different the contexts and countries are, is how similar the results have been across all three countries. And so, mm-hmm. in fact, I think one of the things I learned about this intervention, we tried to design it as an intervention that could be broadly applied to lower and middle income country settings. And I think we did a fairly good job there, given the results and how consistent they've been in each country.
Yeah. And I think the intervention itself has a lot of potential across a lot of different countries. I think there are some aspects of bias that we won't be able to move with this intervention, though. And so, for example, unmarried women in Pakistan, that was really just a non-starter. We couldn't even have our mystery clients pretend to be unmarried women and go to the clinics, except for in a very, very careful way, because that puts them in danger. And so it's just not something that happens. That's not really an element of provider bias that we'd be able to change in that context.
So, of course, the final thing is if you wanted to scale this up, then you have to engage policymakers. Policymakers have biases as well. Would it be a challenge, do you think, to engage them, make them think that this was a priority and be able to shift their cultural biases?
I think it does depend on where we're looking, right? So if you look at data coming out of sub-Saharan Africa right now, this is a region which has some of the highest rates of unintended youth pregnancies, some of the highest rates of new HIV and STI infections, also amongst the younger population. So potentially easier to move the needle there with policymakers. I think in Pakistan, other countries in South Asia, it might be a bit harder given some of the social and cultural norms around sexual activity in a setting where young women are not married.
And one of the good things about working with the Gates Foundation is they really are a policymaker. And so they were interested in this question because they wanted to potentially scale it up broadly. And I know the Ministry of Health in Burkina Faso was very interested in scaling this up after the intervention. And they've been in discussions with other policymakers around there. So their goal is to promote things that they find to be effective. And so that's one of the big benefits about working with a big funder like that.
Reading about this, it was fascinating. The details of how you created the intervention, the interdisciplinary nature of it, and of course, the complexity of what you're doing makes the results very interesting for a very challenging problem. Thank you, Manisha.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Zach.
Thanks, Tim.
This has been published everywhere. Now, if you want to read about it, Reducing Bias Among Healthcare Providers, Experimental Evidence from Tanzania, Burkina Faso, and Pakistan. And I'm going to call that Wagner et al. That was published in the Economic Journal in 2025. Characterizing Provider Bias in Contraceptive Care in Tanzania and Burkina Faso, a Mixed Methods Study. And that's going to be Wollum et al. Yeah, that's published in Social Science and Medicine, 348. That's in 2024. Multi-component intervention to reduce bias during family planning visits, qualitative insights on implementation for Burkina Faso, Pakistan, Tanzania. That's Mushero et al. Contraception and Reproductive Medicine, 2024. And Contraceptive Care Visit Objectives and Outcomes, evidence from Burkina Faso, Pakistan, Tanzania. That's Mushero et al. As well. Studies in Family Planning, 2024. They deal with different aspects of the intervention that is reflected in the title of the journals. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, subscribe, follow us. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you find articles about the topics we feature. If you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us. Give us a review as well. It's great to see some more reviews popping up. Great to see some more good reviews popping up as well. Thank you very much. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hani and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.